Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I know it's week five, Trinity term. Everyone's already very exhausted, but thank you for coming. I think, you know, I'm really excited for our session today. And today we have Dr. Haroon Bashir, who's the head of research, course leader for MA Islamic Studies and senior lecturer in Islamic Studies at the Markfield Institute of Higher Education. And he completed his PhD in Islamic Studies at the University of Leeds. His research was funded by the White Rose College of Arts and Humanities. And he focuses on discourses pertaining to slavery, race, and emancipation. And before this, you did your master's here.
Once upon a time, at
Roxford as well. So in Islamic Studies, Department of Religion.
Study of religion it was, yeah.
So welcome back
to Oxford,
yeah.
Thank you.
And you also did your BA at University of Leeds.
Yes.
So I think in Islamic Studies, because I have your bio here, so I'm trying to make sure that I haven't really butchered your your bio. And today we have a very, very interesting talk. It's based on your book that was just published in 2025, earlier this year in January, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And I know some of my students who took the course with me last term, Modern Islamic Thought, we actually looked at your book and we read your book in class. So this is really exciting for some of us because we've engaged with your work. I'm not going to put pressure on the students to actually ask questions, but you've read the work. So again, the topic is going to be on slavery, abolition, and Islam. This book was published by Oxford University Press. If you're interested, we also have a flyer with 30% discount, which you can grab later. And without further delay, I will invite Dr. Haroon Bashir to present the findings of his book.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you, Rehan, to the Middle East Center, to you guys for turning up. Hi, Justin. The book is kind of £80, so don't do that, don't buy it. I'm sure a PDF will be circulating somewhere. Thank you for the invite. Happy to be here, happy to be back, in fact. Writing the book was tough, but trying to condense everything I talk about in the book down to 50 minutes was even more so. So if the lecture is somewhat elliptical, just, you know, you can pick me up on that on the Q&A. What I'll try and do is provide an overview of the book, and what I try to do is explore a history of theological discourses within Islamic thought, highlighting the genealogy of conversations pertaining to slavery and emancipation, and eventually abolition when they emerge in round about the late 19th century, when Muslim scholarship imbibes abolitionist visions and charts new directions for Islam. Which leads to the development of an interpretive movement I refer to as Islamic abolitionism. So this, to my mind, is significant for two reasons. Firstly, the fact that Islamic abolitionism even existed is a disputed claim for some. It hasn't necessarily been acknowledged or excavated. There's still a strong current of thought that argues, in fact, that Islam was a hindrance to abolition, not that Islam helped support abolition. And this was famously encapsulated in the work of Bernard Lewis, in which he stated, "The abolition of slavery within the Muslim world would hardly have been possible without foreign intervention." Now, of course, that's a very problematic claim for a number of reasons, and Lewis has been roundly critiqued for attempting to provide justification for colonial rule through his polemical conceptualizations of the world. And in regard to slavery, the role of colonial powers is far more complex than is often envisaged. Scholars have noted that abolitionists were occasionally deeply racist and held very dehumanizing views. Others have increasingly cited the impact slave rebellions had on the viability of slavery as a profitable institution. That's to say, hundreds of slave rebellions took place throughout the 18th and 19th century prior to the shifts in rhetoric regarding the viability of slavery. And that's not even to mention instances in which Western powers promoted slavery in the Muslim world in a bid to preserve slave labour within regions that were economically beneficent to colonial powers. As such, Lovejoy claims that colonial powers occasionally became the defenders of slavery and the greatest single impediment to full emancipation. And that's one of the entry points for the book. I attempt to highlight the articulation of abolitionist ideals across non-Western linguistic registers, namely the engagement of Muslim scholarship with abolitionist thought and the birth of, as I mentioned, Islamic abolitionism. In doing so, I try to shift away from civilizational polemics and help provide a more nuanced reading of slavery and abolition. And with that, I should also add that that isn't to diminish or discount British abolitionist efforts either. Of course, it played a role. It's simply to note that privileging particular voices and erasing others altogether tends to produce a distorted image of the past, and we all appreciate how problematic that can be. So that's the first reason why I think this particular area of study is important, to challenge simplistic and superficial narratives regarding the history of the world, and specifically the history of abolition. The second entry point centers more around our understandings of Islam, the development of theology, law, and ethics in Islamic thought, and specifically Islam's conversation with modernity. Abolitionist readings of all religious traditions are relatively recent. In the history of scripture, whether the Bible or the Quran, these readings emerge in the modern world. Now, in the modern day, of course, Jews, Christians, and Muslims collectively promote abolition and condemn slavery unreservedly. Well, mostly, but we'll get to that towards the end. And if you've read the book, you'll know what I'm referencing there. But how did we get there? And how did that change rupture claims of continuity, tradition, and authority within Islamic thought? The story of how abolitionism became hegemonic within Islamic thought remains generally underexplored, and the genealogy of how this position came to be prevalent, its main protagonists and opponents, their methods and arguments, and how the marriage of Islam and abolition came to be cemented is something that I look at in the book, which is the second reason why I believe the topic is significant. Not simply to recount an untold aspect of history, but also to highlight the internal transformations of Islam as an evolving tradition, a discursive tradition, constantly being made and remade, fashioned and refashioned, and demonstrating how change is happening all the time, whether or not people may realize that to be the case. And so those are the two key entry points for the book, that scholars promoting the abolition of slavery existed, that their ideas, while originally marginal, became hegemonic, and secondly, what that radical shift means for the way we understand and conceptualize Islamic thought more generally. So before we explore the main arguments in the book, I should note a few points. As a matter of historical accuracy, scholars of slavery have consistently maintained that slavery within the Islamic world differed from the transatlantic experience in marked ways. Emancipation was relatively common, sometimes automatic after 7 years. Slaves were able to own property and occasionally other slaves. Good luck making sense of that. And slavery was not racialized in the same manner as the transatlantic context. The majority of enslaved peoples within the Islamic context were Asian and not African. And while there were indisputably those who faced lives of exploitation, abuse, and maltreatment, there are also surprising narratives in which slaves within the Islamic world became wealthier than their masters, led contingents of free men as military generals, and even established ruling dynasties of their own. As one example, consider the remarkable tale of Englishmen enslaved by Barbary pirates in the 17th century. The English monarch of the time, Charles II, commissioned an envoy, Captain Hamilton, to negotiate their release. While these men were given the opportunity to return to England as free men, they simply refused. In his letters, Hamilton noted that they actively chose to remain enslaved in place of returning as free men to England. Now, these types of examples are found scattered across Islamic history, across dynasties, geographies, and time periods. Malik Ambar, an enslaved African boy, became one of the most powerful figures in India and challenged the Mughals' power. Ibrahim Pasha, an enslaved Venetian, became the Grand Vizier of the Ottomans. Shajar ad-Daud was a former concubine who became the Empress of the Mamluks. Atta ibn Abi Rabah became the Mufti of Mecca within the first Islamic century. However, it's also worth noting that it was these types of narratives, as well as the key differences between slavery across the two civilizations, that were used by some to challenge abolition. Abolition in the Islamic world was simply not necessary, they proclaimed. Emancipation, the lack of racialization, the social mobility afforded to the enslaved were all cited as justifications for its continuation from those attempting to defend the practice. Now, to what extent these arguments have provided ideological justification for the continuation of slavery remains a provocative question. Saudi Arabia allowed slavery to be practiced up until 1962. The Sultanate of Oman abolished the practice in 1970, and Mauritania was the final country to do so in 1981. Mauritania has often been described as the last bastion of slavery in the contemporary world, and interestingly for some, it is also viewed as an exemplar of a traditional Islam untouched by modernity, reform, or change. And so with that, that's essentially what the book tries to make sense of: these differing positions, these differing theological claims, and how they impact the conversations regarding slavery, emancipation, and abolition. So let's begin the discussion with an exploration of Quranic discourses and the way the exegetical tradition engages with that. Within the Quran, the subject of slavery is only treated relatively briefly. Out of the approximately 6,600 verses in the Quran, slavery is referenced in roughly around 30, and some of that terminology possesses polysemic potential: abd, fatah, fatayat. Whether or not this is necessarily referencing slavery, I mean, every prophet is referred to as Abdullah at some point in the Quran. However, other terms clearly reference slavery, such as raqaba, literally the nape of the neck, and milk al-yameen, right-hand possessions. Scholars have noted the lack of references to slavery in the Quran, certainly in strong contrast to the discussions that we find in later legal traditions, and it appears to demonstrate, at least for some, that slavery wasn't particularly prevalent in the early Muslim community. In fact, even some of the terms that are used in later legal discourse have fundamentally different meanings in the Quranic text. Jariyah, for example, doesn't refer to a slave. In terms of the verses that do relate to slavery, there are a number that promote the emancipation of slaves as an expiation of particular sins or because it's a righteous act in the eyes of God. And interestingly, there are virtually no proclamations or pronouncements calling for the enslavement of the free. Now, I say virtually no, because there's a strongly contested debate regarding the verse Q4-7-4. So this verse is set in the context of a battle and reads that once you've defeated your enemies, bind them firmly, later free them as an act of grace or by ransom until the war comes to an end. So, فَإِمَّا مَنَّ بَعْدْ وَإِمَّا فِدَى. Right, manna being release them from grace, fida being ransom. So this is the only verse in the exegetical tradition that's read as justifying the enslavement of captives. And what the abolitionists slightly later, of course, we'll get to them, note is that there's no mention of slavery in this verse, right? Two options are given. Now, the only manner in Islamic law that one could legally enslave a free person is through captivity following war, and the ostensible justification is a citation of this verse. So if this is the only verse that's cited to justify the legitimacy of enslavement, this is the only verse that is cited to justify the legitimacy of enslavement in the classical exegetical tradition, and interestingly enough, as the abolitionists argue, it doesn't mention slavery. However, exegetes use hadith traditions and seerah material to expand the meaning of the verse, and they argued while the Quran only notes two options with captives, which is to free captives out of grace or ransom, there's actually four or potentially five, depending on the exegete. The others include enslavement or potentially execution. And of course, for the reformists and the abolitionists, the direct recourse is to scripture. They're not bound by centuries of exegetical tradition, nor are they particularly convinced by the veracity of hadith tradition. So for someone like Sayyid Ahmed Khan, he uses this exact same verse to argue that the Quran doesn't allow slavery at all. It doesn't allow any sort of enslavement. And of course, depending on how one feels about exegesis, that may or may not be persuasive. Nevertheless, while there was little from the Quran promoting enslavement, classical commentaries did serve to embed the institution of slavery within a normative model of an idealized society. That is to say, slavery wasn't simply viewed as an unpleasant reality that was to be tolerated. It was actively viewed as part of the divine order through which God demonstrated his grace and favor on the prosperous and was testing the less fortunate with trials and tribulations. Now again, that's not to argue that freedom and manumission were not celebrated as meritorious and commendable, nor is it a dismissal of the emphasis numerous scholars place on the importance of emancipation within their works. However, it is an acknowledgement that the distinction between slaves and masters was considered a legitimate hierarchical structure that in the minds of many classical scholars mirrored God's relationship with creation. The power dynamic between master and slave was often read as analogous to God's supremacy over his dominion, and the fact that a human being could be legally owned, bought, and sold by another was viewed as a legitimate mode of transaction. As noted by Suyuti in his discussion of slavery, God has preferred some of you over others. And much of this is read through a lens that could arguably be described as a kind of metaphysics of hierarchy. Right? Hierarchy is part and parcel of the natural world, and slavery is seen through that paradigm. Importantly, on numerous points, an emancipatory trend can be recovered, which attempts to facilitate the opportunity to attain freedom for enslaved peoples. Sometimes completely counterintuitively in comparison to what one might expect. And this perhaps stems from the numerous current verses imploring the emancipation of the enslaved. And though that didn't translate into a fully fledged anti-slavery hermeneutic as such, these types of positions certainly were developed and built upon by Islamic abolitionist thought. And just on this, it's also important to contextualize some of these exegeses so we can situate them a little bit better. I mean, occasionally when I speak about this, there are questions about, well, why didn't scholars in the past, you know, speak out against slavery more strongly? In the book, I work with Razi's Mafatih al-Ghaib, Qurtubi's al-Jami al-Ahkam, Tafsir ibn Kathir, among others. And to put this into context, I mean, Razi was a contemporary of Genghis Khan. Right, Qurtubi was born around the time the Magna Carta was being ratified in 1215, and Ibn Kathir was writing while the bubonic plague was decimating half of the population in Europe. That's to say that the lens through which these scholars engaged with the Quran was naturally influenced by the worlds they occupied, and in that sense, their positions are relatively what you would expect them to be for people who lived in those times. Now, of course, that does raise, I would argue, important questions for Islamic spaces today that do not teach these commentaries as historically situated, but as uniquely authoritative renditions of Islam. And these are fundamentally questions to be answered about how tradition is conceptualized in those instances. But that seems to me to be a question about contemporary expectations of an inherited tradition than a conversation about the tradition itself. So, moving on to Islamic law. There were far more discussions on slavery in legal texts because I would argue they compiled after Islam becomes an empire. Enslavement was legitimized in classical Islamic law through two legal avenues. The first of these was for those who were born into slavery, and the second was lawful enslavement through capture in battle. It was accepted amongst the four schools that upon victory in battle, the commander of the Muslims had a choice regarding the treatment of captives, whether that was execution, freedom out of goodwill, ransom, or enslavement. And the schools differed regarding the preference of these options. In legal discussions, enslavement wasn't necessarily encouraged or necessarily discouraged, but the fundamental principle within legal texts stresses the importance of military superiority in a battle. And while it has been argued that perhaps enslavement was a punishment for disbelief, legal rulings appear to demonstrate enslavement was more probably linked to being an enemy of the state. It was equally forbidden to enslave non-Muslims who were citizens of the Muslim state. And to that end, I see some overlaps here with Roman discussions on enslavement and citizenship. So in that limited sense, enslavement practices within Islamic law appear to correspond with other pre-modern slave-owning societies, insofar as enslavement was reserved for those who were considered outside of the community, namely war captives in this instance. Islamic law also stipulated a number of emancipation contracts that served as avenues towards freedom. The Tadbir contract was a promise of emancipation upon the death of the master and was instantiated once the master perished. The Istilad contract was specifically for female slaves who gave birth to the master child and became the Umm al-Walid. Importantly, the child of the Umm al-Walid was born free. And the third contract was the Kitaba, which was premised on a payment of a certain amount of wealth, which ultimately led to the emancipation of the Muqatib. Now, entering into these contracts earned a certain amount of rights for the enslaved person, and their legal status was vastly improved in comparison to those who did not have the contracts. Now, a few times I've mentioned what you can find in the classical tradition is this type of emancipatory ethic that is then fundamentally built on by abolitionists later in history. So let's look at a ruling that kind of demonstrates what I'm speaking about there. So this is from the Mabsut of Saraksi, famous kind of encyclopedia of Hanafi fiqh, and Saraksi is often considered, you know, one of the most important Hanafi jurists that ever lived. And so in this particular fatwa, which I think most people find quite surprising, I'm not sure what people in the room how they'll feel, he has a discussion about a child that is being claimed by two different parties. On one hand, you've got an enslaved Muslim claiming the child is theirs, and on the other hand, you've got a free non-Muslim claiming the child is theirs. And he says, if this happens, the ruling is enacted in favor of the free non-believer. In his statement, there is an affirmation of freedom for the child, and this contains immediate benefit for the child. If the child remains with the enslaved Muslim, the child may not obtain emancipation as they grow, but with the free non-believer, perhaps Allah will guide them and they will become Muslim of their own accord. The final part of the fatwa is really interesting, because what it says is the consideration of the child's freedom is given preference in regard to his rights. Which is to say that the child's freedom almost trumps his adherence to the religion of Islam. And again, most people wouldn't expect a classical Hanafi jurist to be saying that. In fact, I think if Saraksi said that today, someone would have a quiet word and say, you're not allowed to say that. But it exists, and these types of rulings are not rare. I mean, I haven't got time to go into lots of them right now, but in the book I look at, you know, lots of these different examples in which you can see that scholars and jurists are going out of their way to facilitate emancipation, sometimes contradicting the basic usul of the Sharia, but doing whatever they can to allow people to become free. And it was these types of rulings that Muslim abolitionists ultimately latched onto and said, look, you can see that there's always been an emancipatory ethic within Islamic law. So abolition isn't necessarily something new in Islam. It was what we were always aiming at. And we'll get to Abdul and Ridha in a second. But importantly, it's important to recognize, so did their opponents, right? So, for example, a 19th century defender of slavery argued, slavery cannot be abolished, as to do so would deny the future generations the opportunity to commit the virtuous deed of emancipating slaves, right? That's it. If emancipating the enslaved is one of the best things you can do, then abolition is taking that away from us, right? And so the authority, and that becomes part of the kind of contestations that emerge in the 19th century. But, I mean, again, one of the key points here is that the authority of classical rulings remains foundational within Islamic law. And therefore, the acceptance of slavery and lack of censure within some of these classical discussions were routinely cited by those that were attempting to defend the practice. To put it very simply, the argument kind of went in the direction of, you don't know better than Abu Hanifa, or Malik, or Shafi, or Ahmed ibn Hanbal. You don't know better than the Salaf. If they didn't abolish slavery, then who are you, Sayyid Ahmed Khan, or who are you, Muhammad Abdu, to try and do something that's never been done? And it's perhaps for this reason that the abolitionist scholars use the demand for abolition to call for the complete reform of Islamic law and profess that the legal system in its classical form needed to be completely reworked and the cartographies of authority needed to be redrawn. So here we have two of the key reformers or abolitionists that I look at. Both of them have got fantastic beards. Sayyid Ahmed Khan's a little bit better, of course. I've just got some catching up to do. But the concept of reform Islah, Tajdeed has of course existed throughout Islamic history. I mean, prior to the 19th century, you've got Shah Wali Allah, you've got Shawqani, you've got a number of other scholars who are, you know, you've got Ibn Abdul Wahhab if you want to go in that direction. And there's constantly been this kind of going back to the sources and reinterpreting for your given context. The difference between the 19th century reformists and those that preceded them was the impact of European colonization and the subsequent loss of sovereignty. Now, panic ensued amongst Muslim intelligentsia due to the prospect of being governed by non-Muslim rulers, as well as the technological, cultural, and epistemic challenges Europe was posing. So it's perhaps due to this that the spaces which constituted the centers of European colonial power, Egypt and India, produced the strongest and most influential revivalist currents. Coming directly into contact with colonial administrations appears to have spurred the strongest feelings of loss and subsequently the loudest calls for revival and reform. Now, two of the most influential projects who attempted to take on this challenge were presented by Khan and Abdu. Khan was working in India and Abdu in Egypt, and though they never formally met, the themes within their work share similar concerns. Both called for the reform of educational spaces, subsequently leading to such reforms in their own institutions, Al-Azhar and what was then the Mohammedan Anglo-Oriental College, later to become Aligarh. Their arguments and style differed somewhat. Abdu was a traditionally trained alim, while Khan was proudly not from the scholastic class, and that influenced their approaches. Nevertheless, within their writings, there were many overlaps. They both spearheaded calls for ijtihad. They both argued for the importance of accessing the Quran without exegetical commentaries. They called for a critical approach to hadith, promotion of scientific worldviews, and both strongly censured traditional religious authorities to varying degrees. Most importantly, they both challenged the legitimacy of slavery and called for abolition in the name of Islam. Now, their approaches differed from other attempts to politically navigate the issue. So, for example, the Ahmed Bey of Tunis was one of the first to prohibit slavery in the Muslim world in the year 1846. Right? However, his argument was that he used the mistreatment of slaves to argue that modern slavery wasn't abiding by the high standards expected in the treatment of enslaved peoples found within Islam. Now, this type of pragmatic political maneuvering was effective, but it didn't necessarily problematize slavery as a concept, nor present Islam as a particularly abolitionist or anti-slavery tradition. The reason why Khan and Abdu are interesting is because they opposed slavery specifically from an Islamic paradigm, and contributed innovative approaches to reading scripture and tradition as decisively anti-slavery. So, in the 1870s, Khan wrote a work entitled Iddali Ghulami, The Refutation of Slavery, and was one of the first to truly address the problem of slavery systematically within his work. As Smith notes, no Muslim of his generation was as categorical or as zealous in attacking slavery as Ahmed Khan, so much so that some have described him as the Muslim Wilberforce. Unlike the scholars of his time, Khan condemned the practice and called it un-Islamic and immoral, and argued that we have to be certain in our hearts that this practice was contrary to the Islamic religion. Now, Khan's main thesis claimed that the Quran had not simply restricted slavery and provided slaves with extra rights, it had in fact ordered the complete abolition of the institution in the 7th century. Again, this was premised on the verse that I mentioned previously, Q 47:4. He said, this verse only allows two options, and if you go back to the Quran directly, there's not a single verse that allows you to enslave people. So he argues, with this verse, the Prophet Muhammad abolished slavery and proclaimed that all those captured should be set free. However, Muslim scholars have erroneously interpreted these verses due to the following of traditional cultural customs, and they therefore proclaimed it legitimate. And so with that, you see the kind of modernist move. He divides the Islamic tradition between the early period, which is the correct period, and later historical Islam that has accrued innovations, heresies, and misinterpretations. The reason for the historical acceptance of slavery was due to historical accretions, and not due to the original message of the Prophet Muhammad, according to Sayyid Ahmed Khan. he argues, there's not a single verse or authentic hadith that permits slavery. However, the ulama attempt to legitimize slavery through their misinterpretations and present them as valid. Of course, linked to this, he was very skeptical of hadith traditions more broadly. And he sought to deny that these materials represented Islamic history or the Prophet. For Khan, the Prophet Muhammad was the highest ethical ideal, and anything within the hadith traditions that contradicted his good conduct would need to be rejected. A lot of Khan's arguments ultimately sought to undermine classical Islamic law and display it as corrupt and unworkable. This subsequently indicted much of the ulama as defenders of an adulterated tradition and framed reformers like Khan as the true representatives of the Islamic tradition. As expected, these revisionist policies drew heavy criticism from all sections of the Indian ulama. This included fierce condemnation of his proposals and acrimonious disparagement of his motives. Critics accused Khan of being a colonial puppet and a sycophant who was attempting to win favour with the British by altering the essence of the Islamic faith. Probably didn't help that he accepted a knighthood. In a bid to discredit his ideas, rumours were spread that he had actually converted to Christianity, with some going as far to describe him as Dajjal. Interestingly, some of his main contentions, that abolition fits firmly within Islam and that Quran, his main argument, the Quran doesn't contradict science, are very firmly embedded within contemporary Islamic thought today. One need only go down to Hyde Park to see how far his ideas have spread. So I guess everyone's become a little bit Dajjalic now. In the book, I look at kind of three key refutations of Khan. And in these works, you see a strong defense of slavery posited by his detractors. The first is Abdullah al-Askari and his Haqiqat al-Islam, The Reality of Islam. Another text is Radda al-Shikak fi Jivaz al-Istirqaq, Refutation of the Discord Regarding the Permissibility of Slavery. And the third is Sayyid Ahmed Akbar Abadi's Islami Gulamiki Haqiqat, The Reality of Slavery in Islam. Now, the first two were written in the 1870s, and they unapologetically argue for the benefits of slavery. The argument is very simple. Slavery is permissible, it's been established by scripture, and it's agreed upon by ijma. Right? I mean, what's the discussion? Akbar Abadi's text is written in the 20th century, and while his arguments fundamentally affirm the critiques, the tone is quite different. He's a little more apologetic about slavery, right, which would be expected because of the kind of global shift in discourse. But that he exhibits bellicosity towards Khan, who he describes as deceitful, ridiculous, and naive. Now, in the transnational context of the period, the abolitionist positions promoted by Abdul and Ridha were favoured more strongly rather than Khan. I'll get to why in just a second. Now, part of that may have been linguistic, of course. Khan's writing in Urdu, Abdul's in Arabic, and that may have played a role, but I think it's also the style of argument, right? Khan, Abdul and Ridha use traditional Islamic law to justify their arguments, whereas Khan is avidly proclaiming, I'm not an alim, I don't want to be an alim, the ulama are the problem. So chances are ulama are not going to take that argument very well. He did nevertheless impact much of the conversation in South Asia, with many South Asian modernists echoing his arguments, most notably Chirag Ali and Ghulam Ahmed Parvez, strongly supporting and repeating the arguments made by Khan. And when the issue again resurfaces in Pakistan post-independence, it resurfaces in debates between Parvez and one Abul A'la al-Maududi when discussing how captives of war should be treated following warfare, Maududi defending slavery, Parvez using Khan's arguments, which again popularized Khan's arguments further. Till today, you find his arguments repeated in journals, blogs, pamphlets, exegetical works, and other Islamic literature across Pakistan and India. Moving on to our second key figure, Muhammad Abdu. Now, Abdu serves as the Grand Mufti of Egypt in his later years, and much like Khan, he devises programs for educational reform. On the issue of slavery, Abdu has been described as one of the most influential opponents from amongst religious scholars. Robinson Dunn states, Abdu became Grand Mufti in 1899 and was influential in turning the Egyptian public against slavery. He pronounced that abolition was, in fact, in the true spirit of Islam, yet far from wanting to anglicize or westernize, Abdus sought to interpret Islam in light of the contemporary needs of the time, helping to limit the widening gap between religious and secular life in Egypt. As well as his own writings, Abdu's ideas were articulated and propagated further by his student Rashid Ridha through the journal Al-Manar. And Ridha equally challenged the legitimacy of slavery within Islam, though arguably he was more conservative than his teacher on a number of different points. Now, the basic argument is perhaps one you may have heard, that slavery hadn't been completely abolished by the Quran in the 7th century. However, the foundations for abolition had been established due to various calls to emancipate slaves throughout scripture and the restriction of fresh enslavement delineated within Islamic doctrine. As Abdu states, the religion of Islam permitted enslavement in the same manner as all previous religions. However, this religion, advanced in its legal wisdom, in contrast to previous dispensations, did not discontinue the harsh laws all at once. Rather, he claims, Islam challenged the application of these laws and reformed the severe exploitation of slaves that was being practiced in the name of religion. As a result, it can be seen that Islam narrowed the avenues of enslavement, and it becomes clear, beyond a doubt, that the intention of Islamic law was the fundamental eradication of slavery gradually. Ibtala bik asasan bit tadrij, the whole concept of tadrij, kind of incrementally. Unlike Kant, Abdu's approach was more cautious in its reassessment of the religious tradition. The gradualist argument deployed by Abdu utilized the classical tradition instead of completely discounting it in the radical manner Kant had. And to justify his position, Abdu listed various classical legal rulings, like the one that I showed you earlier with Saraksi, to demonstrate there's always been an emancipatory ethic. And therefore, Abdu argued, Islam always sought to eradicate slavery and promote freedom. We also see this in his unique tafsir that became a kind of lasting symbol for those promoting abolition. And this centered around verses in Surah Al-Balad, وَمَا أَدْرَاكُمَ الْأَكَبَ فَقُّ رَكَبَ. In classical tafsir, they don't attempt the steep path. What is the steep path? It's the freeing of the slave. Now, unlike classical commentaries that saw this as a literal call to emancipate a slave, Abdu reread this as a call for abolition wholesale. And therefore, his gradual abolition thesis constituted a kind of distinctive rereading of Islamic law and its objectives. As established, while emancipation was consistently praised, the abolition of slavery was never explicitly cited by classical scholars. However, Abdu used the emancipatory ethic not only to justify the abolition of slavery, moreover to argue that that had always been the intention, to eradicate slavery completely. The persistence of the slave trade within the Muslim world, therefore, was linked to despotic rulers who had abused the law and not the religion of Islam and not necessarily the ulama. And interestingly, within that critique of kind of despotic rulers, we can probably surmise he's critiquing the Ottomans at that point also. Now, this functioned as somewhat of an olive branch to many of the ulama, at least the conservative ulama. You were always on this side, Abdu suggested, right? Abolition is your position, whether or not you recognize that. Which was fundamentally different from Kant, who was saying, no, you are the problem. And therefore, in doing so, Abdu attempted to appease both the religiously orthodox while equally appealing to those of a more secular disposition. His negotiations between conservatism and reform were not always consistent, and he received strong criticism from both positions, from opposing directions. However, due to this cautious approach, Kerr notes that Abdu's own generation and later generations have revered him as a great teacher. Now, his arguments were propagated further by Rashid Ridha, and unlike Abdu, who seemed slightly more enamored by European abolitionism, Ridha strongly questioned the motives of European and American abolitionists. He argued, in neither case were their actions the result of a sincere desire to promote the welfare of mankind. Rather, it was the result of their own self-interest, not because there was any real understanding of equality. And the reason he says this, he highlights, for example, the disparity suffered across racial lines in which the descendants of Europeans exploit other races. He argues, while abolition is promoted on one hand, political slavery is considered legitimate, by European governments and European peoples who see nothing wrong in the oppression of people who are not white. He highlights that the British continue to exploit India, and again he's writing in the 20s and 30s, though slavery has been abolished. And across European colonies, the vestiges of slavery are so apparent that non-white people who convert to Christianity are shunned from white churches. And so for Rida, he fundamentally doesn't trust this. He can't wrap his head around this type of racism, and therefore he's very sceptical of Western abolitionist claims. He argues there must be an ulterior motive. Now, Rida is interesting for a whole host of reasons. We were speaking about this just earlier. He's linked with pan-Islamism, right? Some say there's a direct line between Rida and then Hassan al-Banna. He's linked with Salafism. He's hanging around with Ibn Saud. He's certainly a modernist in particular strands of his thought, and you know, all that he inherits from Abdu. Interestingly, what I found out recently is he's a big fan of Gandhi also. He translates Gandhi's work into Arabic. And then, of course, he popularizes Abdu's idea that abolition was the ultimate aim of Islam from the very beginning. Of course, a key question that emerges from that claim is, well, if that is the case, when did it go wrong? If the abolitionist spirit was subverted, when did this occur? And that's where Rida makes a really interesting move, and he links the demise of the true Islamic spirit to the Umayyad dynasty and Muawiyah in particular. And this becomes a very common theme, a common idea in much of contemporary Islamic discourse, that the Umayyads are the period where things start to go wrong. And that's how you differentiate between the Khulafa al-Rashidun, of course, and what comes next. And of course, the famous work by Maududi also kind of emphasizes that, right? That's when Islam becomes a kingship. But that is in no way a universally held position. Right? Muawiyah was a companion. Yazid is part of the Salaf. The idea that they're being critiqued becomes a real point of contention and demonstrates the different ways that classical heritage is being read and reread. But it also highlights the way in which pan-Islamists are a point of departure from classical Sunni thought in particular ways, and that continues till today. Maududi, for example, was lambasted by the Deobandis for criticizing the companions of the Prophet, and he said, we're allowed to do this, right? Similarly, according to scholars based in Jordan or Syria, the Umayyads are the most noble of dynasties. How can they be the time when it went wrong? You wouldn't have the Dome of the Rock, you wouldn't have Andalusia, which you all celebrate, right? So it's just an interesting shift in direction, especially due to how common that position has become in contemporary Islamic thought. So to kind of summarize, Abdu and Rida's chronic gradualism argument claims that the rulings found within the Quran Hadith, which subsequently informed Islamic law, espoused an emancipatory ethic. Therefore, it had always been the purpose of Islam to eradicate slavery from the world. Through the restriction of acquiring new slaves and the emphasis on emancipating those who were already enslaved, slavery would have been eradicated within a few generations. The reason this didn't take place was the misuse of Islamic law by political elites, and while it's completely legitimate to criticize their actions, you can't criticize Islam for that. Oh, sorry. Okay, just quickly then. I mean, some might have assumed that because Abdu was the Grand Mufti of Egypt and Sheikh al-Azhar, he was kind of insulated from criticism. Of course, that wasn't the case, right? He and Rida were referred to as the Protestants of Islam who were attempting to annihilate Islam and abolish the Sharia. And two of the texts I look at were written, one was by Hussein al-Jisr and the other was by Yusuf al-Nabahani. And again, they defend the institution of slavery and claim slavery was part of a natural hierarchy that helped establish balance in the world. It was allowed in Judaism, it was allowed in Christianity, it was allowed in Islam. And most importantly, and interestingly, they argue, it's not an expedient argument. It's not that slavery is better than poverty, right? They try to argue that it's fundamentally a good thing for society. Slaves and masters benefit from one another, right? And so, however, irrespective of these critiques, Abdu's argument catches hold. It marries traditional Islamic law with abolition and allows Muslim scholarship to claim abolition is inherent to the Islamic tradition. And many scholars began to cite this argument. Two key proponents who echo this are Ibn Ashur, again, one of the most prominent thinkers in the 20th century, and the very famous Sayyid Qutb, who's again, very popular for a variety of different reasons. And in their work, they quote Ridha's position on abolition verbatim. Now, Qutb is, of course, famously critiqued for a whole host of reasons. I think someone described him as the Karl Marx of Al-Qaeda once. But the interesting one that people often miss is that he's excommunicated by the famous Salafi scholar Al-Fawzan because he advocates for the abolition of slavery. So to summarize then the arguments of the Islamic abolitionists, the global conversation regarding the permissibility of slavery shifted drastically within the 19th century and early 20th century. And within the Muslim world, two key reading formations challenged the notion that slavery was compatible with Islam. One was presented by Khan and the other by Abdu. The argument centered upon the lack of material allowing enslavement within the Quran. That is to say, the fact that there were virtually no commands in the Quran that encouraged the enslavement of free people. And much of the material permitting slavery was in fact found in exegesis and legal material. However, this was not particularly problematic for these scholars, as they encouraged Muslims to go back to the sources and bypass centuries of cultural accretions and misinterpretations and influences from other civilizations. And therefore, they argued that abolition was part of the true message of Islam, not a modern rereading. Now, from the two, the gradualist method gained far more popularity across the Muslim world, to the extent that arguably it's a hegemonic position amongst contemporary Islam today. And again, in the book, I kind of run through a number of different scholars who repeat the same argument from many different directions, whether that's Fazlur Rahman or Muhammad Asad, Fethullah Gulen, Mahmoud Daha, Abdullah Naim, Amina Wadud, Asma Barlas, Abdullah Saeed. I mean, anyone talking about slavery in the contemporary period is making the argument originally put forth by Abdul and Ridha. And interestingly, even traditional spaces now use the same argument, right? Though seldom mention Abdu or think about the implications the argument has for manifestations of Islamic law. So, as a final point then, in the contemporary world, we can thankfully see an aversion to slavery across the board. However, there is a question that remains regarding an interpretive issue across religious traditions regarding a question of slavery. There appears to be a link between literalist traditions that conceptualize authoritative interpretations as historically situated. And as a result of those particular hermeneutical positionalities, there are very kind of occasionally cases in which slavery is not critiqued and very, very occasionally in fact promoted. And of course that's not limited to Islam. As I demonstrate in the book, you see, you know, in the Orthodox Jewish tradition, there are similar conversations. A particular rabbi, Rabbi Kashtil, head of a military religious college in Israel, was captured on camera extolling the virtues of slavery, stating that being a slave to a Jew is the best, and when Palestinians become slaves, their lives can begin to take shape. Similarly, literalist evangelical pastors in the US have been seen to promote the virtues of slavery, citing the Bible as justification. Post-Trump, I think some of this has gone really crazy, but there we are. And equally, we see it within the Orthodox Muslim discourse as well. There are similar types of discussions. So I look at some of these. The world-renowned Diobandi Mufti, Taqi Usmani, only in 2015, says, "The clear manifest truth is that taking slaves is permissible in Islam with its laws and its limits, and nothing is abrogated. And there are wisdoms in this, which we have explained, and the opinion of its abrogation is rejected and is against consensus and has no proofs from the proofs of the Sharia." Now, of course, he's not saying that we should practice slavery, right? He's saying slavery shouldn't be practiced because there's a pact established through the United Nations that nobody should be doing it. However, theoretically, he argues it's part of the tradition and he doesn't want to kind of alter that tradition. Therefore, theoretically, it's allowed, but we shouldn't practice it. And then to kind of close, and as I do with the book, when I look at these kind of contemporary discussions, my analysis is to say something that is perhaps fairly simple, I suppose. Scholars and thinkers are shaped by their environments. In the classical world, in which slavery was normalized, Muslim scholarship accepted the legitimacy of slavery and regulated the practice. Throughout the 19th century, groups of reformist Muslim scholars began to promote Islamic abolitionism, as abolitionist ideas began to gain traction globally. As the Orthodox tradition was developed and crystallized in a period in which slavery was a normalized practice, Orthodoxy has remnants of that time in which it was crystallized. However, as reformist readings were formulated in an age of abolition, those interpretations represent the sensibilities that were current when they were being constructed, and therefore they're attuned to an abolitionist outlook. Earlier in the presentation, I made reference to the verse in Surat al-Balad, "Wama adraka ma al-aqaba faqu raqaba," what will make you realize the steep path is liberating the slave. Classical jurists understood this as referring to the literal manumission of a slave. And in the 19th century, Abdu read it to mean the complete eradication of the slave trade. In a post-abolition world, perhaps new generations of theologians will emerge, transforming its meaning once again to challenge contemporary forms of oppression and expanding Islamic thought towards new vistas of knowledge and towards new horizons when it comes to the question of social justice. Current reports suggest that there are currently 50 million people in situations of modern slavery. That's 50, right? And that becomes a question then. In place of discussing the virtues of what slavery was, as some people do, how do we go out to actively challenge the fact that there are people in these beleaguered, oppressed situations? And that is, again, one of the directions in the epilogue I talk about where Islamic thought could go, right? Now, for some, of course, these interpretive potentialities may appear slightly problematic for those who attempt to situate Islam in the past. As I've hopefully demonstrated, Islam is constantly being made and remade, fashioned and refashioned by Islamic thinkers in any given context, and will continue to be so. To that end, you know, Muslim thinkers, the way they understand what the divine wants will constantly be reassessed, reviewed, and corrected based on our understandings of ethics at any given point. And I suppose in a sense, that's the way it's always been, and in a way, that's the only way it could ever be. And on that note then, I'll finish with the same phrase I finish the book with, which are the famous words of the companion Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, who says, "Mara al-Muslimuna hasanan fa indallahi hasan." What the believers deem to be good is good with Allah. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, thank you so much for that very wonderful presentation. It's, you know, comprehensive. You've looked at Islam's positions on slavery from classical fiqh to reformist thinkers, and then their detractors, and how you also discuss what contemporary scholars have said as well when it comes to slavery. I think this is a really rich presentation. Thank you so much for that.